Dr. Beezer thought he was having a nervous breakdown. Remember Dr. Beezer?
Dr. Beezer?
Yes.
No, not at all. Actually.
Director of the Department of Defense Alien Incursion Response Team?
Ah, now I know who they are.
Yeah, we last heard from him 7 years ago when he was trying to learn the intricacies of Whiskers' six.
Oh, and essay number 272 about the harmonic convergence.
Was it?
Yes.
Oh, of course. Yeah, well, Whiskers 6
You think I'm kidding you? Like, I didn't do research on this.
Right.
This morning.
Okay, Whiskers 6 Draw,
yes.
A card game so confusing that a new system of probability theory had to be devised to explain the rules. For the first 2 years, Beezer struggled with a basic shuffle and deal, and only figured out how to tally points when he applied the hypothesis of general misinterpretation, viz.
The rate at which anything can be misunderstood increases in direct proportion to the attempt to correct the error.
In the end, which was just last July, he threw in the whiskers-covered towel and began to spend way too much time staring at the world through the bottom of a sparkling wine bottle. He had a bottle with him now, and he was swinging it around in a circle above his head. It was empty, and he didn't know what else to do with it. But he felt like he had to do something because the world around him had suddenly changed. He had been attending a stirring performance of Casserole for a Large Orchestra by the Erie Philharmonic at the orchestra's reverberant outdoor amphitheater. Seated front and center, he was enjoying the waves of fortissimo sound as it washed over him and parted his hair in the middle. But just as the orchestra eased back into a long stretch of mezzo forte, a concession stand operator strode through the audience hawking CDs and cassette recordings, his boombox blaring snippets of music incompatible with a live performance. The patron to Beezer's right waved the concessionaire over, and the two of them engaged in a loud negotiation of the value of the popular Etude Brute recording. When a price was at last agreed upon, the buyer pulled from his pocket a handful of coins and dropped them. Where's our coin?
I don't have any coins.
No?
You should warn me.
Wait.
Okay, that's good. Big coins.
Big coin.
Roman
coins
made out of magic markers.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. Brute. Etude Brute. Wait a minute. Didn't you write an Etude Brute about 35 years ago
or
something?
And it's coming back.
Ah.
Right. When they rolled noisily all over the amphitheater's metal flooring, startling more than a few spectators into consciousness. One of them bent over to retrieve some coins, lost his balance, and began rolling on the floor, too. The amphitheater seating was so steeply raked that he slid all the way down to the front of the stage. Oh, well. With an accompanying glissando from the violas, he disappeared down the drain with a yelp. A plume of steam then rose from the grate. Thin at first, it soon grew so thick that it obscured the conductor. The music, too, picked up steam again as a casserole reached the noodle movement.
A la Ramen.
Yeah. Wherein the offstage bagpipe choir improvised loudly and haphazardly. Two audience members responded by unsheathing their own sets of bagpipes and hurling skirls back at the orchestra. A woman in the balcony was suddenly snatched from her seat by a large condor, and her screams provided a ululating counterpoint to a trill from the piccolo. Oh, hell. The casserole always seemed to invite chaos, and this performance was proving to be no exception. Then the kettle drums exploded. Beezer instinctively ducked and threw his arms.
It doesn't work when there's a thing over the microphone. Normally you can blow into it and it sounds like an explosion, but there's this big orange nostril here in my way.
You could pick the nostril off.
I could do that. Wait, let's do the explosion. It still didn't work. Yeah. What's wrong with this mic? All right.
Okay.
There.
Protective sheath back on.
Yes, it is.
Safe sex microphone.
Safe sex microphone.
The blast was formidable, and for a while he couldn't hear anything save for a ringing in his ears. Okay. When the sound at last dissipated, the world for Dr. Beezer had changed. The amphitheater, orchestra, and audience were all gone. He was sitting in the middle of a field with no buildings anywhere in sight. Clutched in his hand was a sparkling wine bottle, half empty. He took stock of his surroundings. They seemed normal enough. Blue sky, white clouds, green grass, brown mountains, yellow sun, purple wildflowers, red herring, orange river. Orange river?
Orange river.
That was enough to disorient him. He tipped back the bottle and polished off its contents in one big gulp. The world spun a bit, and Beezer thought he saw a giant steaming casserole arise from the ground in front of him. He shut his eyes and shook his head to clear it. What? Was that the wail of bagpipes in the distance? I don't think so. When he opened his eyes, he looked into a purple sky with a yellow sky with purple clouds and a brown sun. The grass around him was red, and the wildflowers were blue, though not a shade of blue he'd ever seen before. The mountains were white, the herring were green, and the river was still orange.
Still orange.
The ground shuddered, and as he glanced down, he saw hundreds of worms, nematodes, spurt from the earth and converge on him. From all directions they came, and Beezer was quickly surrounded. With no other recourse, he began to swing the bottle and yell. As he spun around, the padding of his feet on the ground sounded exactly like the shuffling of a deck of cards as all five queens wriggle out of it. One of the ploys of the Whiskers' six-draw dealer.
What?
Oh, no, nothing. I thought you were leaning over to...
I was about faint. To do something.
Okay. Beezer flung the bottle as far as he could, but forgot to let go. The hypothesis of general misinterpretation was on its best behavior as it deposited both Beezer and bottle a good half mile away in a heap at the front door of a tiny nondescript cottage that seemed to fade into and out of focus. His trousers were rumpled, but otherwise Beezer was unharmed. A skirl of bagpipes emanated from behind the door, as did the harsh laugh of a condor. And a duel between trumpet and bassoon that he recognized as Etude Boutet's B theme. Charily, he pushed open the door. The groan of the rusted hinges, while loud, did not prepare him for the utter cacophony that followed. Sound, not all of it pleasant, attacked him from all directions. Little rackets nipped at his heels. A pandemonium reared up and pushed him indifferently against a wall. A pair of dins stood in front of him, yowling unremittingly. A large, unmannered rumpus circled him, clamoring and smelling of rancid casserole. It was at this point of inharmonic convergence that Beezer thought he was having a nervous breakdown. Roughly pushing a noisy hullabaloo out of his way, he made for the door. One of the dins grabbed his foot, and he flailed at it with his bottle. He bumped against the pandemonium and went down in a heap. All of the noises hovered over him then, and he thought he would surely lose his mind. Instinctively, he blew into his bottle. The note that sounded was deep and resonant, like the roll on an unexploded timpani. Suddenly, all of the sounds began to shift into harmonic agreement. Open fifths, perfect fourths, and minor thirds abounded, until they all resolved into the universal chord of Charuppa Vets. Beezer struggled to his feet and out the door. The sky was blue again, and the herring were red, but the river was still orange. Well, there didn't seem to be anything he could do about it, and neither is there anything that we can do about this 527th episode of Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar, an inharmonic convergence in its own right that's about to be remedied by restorative music from our special guest, preceded by potentially therapeutic introductory remarks from Calvos.
No therapy here.
Oh, no.
Never therapy here.
Oh, sorry, then.
Just some more inharmonicness. We're listening to a mix of...
Another Calvin.
Yes, of course, a brand new piece by Marco Opedizano called... What is it called?
Well,
Move! That's what it's called. Along with the second cut from an illegal art CD, Meisel, from
Meiseltoff?
Astro Hello World.
Ah.
The kind of mixes we love around here.
No. Thank you.
By Marco Opedizano, overwritten here and there by a cut from O Astro Hello World called Meisel.
I'm glad we were able to give Marco's piece such deference.
Yes, careful attention. Mm-hmm. That's what we like to give
attention
music
to
here.
Detail.
Speaking of attention to detail, we have a live guest in the studio, which is kind of unusual because we've been stood up a couple of times recently. Eric Lyon decided to just simply forget he was supposed to show up,
right.
And then Pamela Z thought a family wedding was more important than us. How could that be?
But now we have another a real Californian.
Yeah, that's right. What's happening to us?
Does this mean we can go out there next?
We could. That's right. We can get laid back and comfortable. Our guest today is Barry Schrader, who's here all the way from Cal Arts. Wow, that's scary. Welcome to Calvin St. Damian.
Thank you. I'm still trying to figure out the Whiskers 6 draw.
Well, there are instructions. I don't know if they're posted, but...
No, we haven't posted the instructions yet.
We were going to make an interactive game, were you not?
We were, but I needed the instructions from you.
You mean that would help?
Well, yeah, because that way we could market it.
Oh.
And if there's something that we're good at doing, it's marketing stuff.
Yeah,
yeah.
Right, okay. Yeah.
Oh.
Could make a good video game.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So welcome to Calvin and Damian. Now, you're not allowed to figure out Whisker Six Draw.
Oh.
That is not in the cards, as it
Calvin
were.
Mars.
Yes. So you're going to tell us about you. We learned of you first through your music, and secondly, because Susie Allen, a former guest on Calvin and Damian, said, Barry's my mentor.
Was
my mentor.
When
yes.
Susie was a student at CalArts back at the very beginning, 1970, 71, 72. I was her mentor, and now she's assistant dean.
And you're still...
No, she's more my mentor now.
I see. She determines whether you get a raise or not. Is that what it is? So how did that happen? I mean, how did you get into music? Now, people have heard some of your stuff on our show, and it's very rich electronic and very sort of passionate electronics. And how did you come to music and to electronic music after that?
Oh, well, I started music, I started taking piano lessons at the age of 5.
Ah!
So it's been pretty continuous.
Was that in California or were you in...
No, I was born in Pennsylvania, Johnstown, Pennsylvania.
Ah, the oil capital.
The flood capital.
The flood capital, yeah. And used to be steel capital, but not too much anymore. So I've been in music most of my life. And I was a graduate student in musicology at the University of Pittsburgh when they decided to build an electronic music studio in 1960, at the end of 1968.
What were you doing being a graduate student in musicology? I'm confused.
I think it beats
that.
Butlering.
Well, remember we had talked earlier.
We didn't talk earlier. You were talking to somebody else.
Okay.
Now you're here with Calvos, and that means that
we know nothing. I had gotten my undergraduate, my bachelor's from Pitt, as we call it. And then I had gone to Rutgers, unfortunately, for one miserable term.
Yes, and you were there the same time I was, interestingly enough.
And I quickly left, went back to Pittsburgh, and made pizza for a while. until I could get into graduate school there. And at that time, they didn't have a composition program. And I was very interested in old music, medieval music.
Uh-huh, yep.
And they had some really excellent people there. A Dr. Robert Snow, who had worked a lot with Willie Apple. This is very esoteric.
Willie Apple being one of those people who created the book that we all had stole from the various college libraries, and that was the Historical Anthology of Music, for those of you who are wondering about Willie Apple. It's a great collection about the late 1940s.
Or if you are a librarian wondering where they went.
Yes, you could be wondering where they went.
But he also did the texts on transcription of medieval music. And so I was doing that when they decided to set up an electronic music studio. And lo and behold, they made me the TA. And so that's how I got into it, and I've been doing it ever since.
And you hadn't done it before? This was new to you? You just went in and say, oh, I like these buttons. I'm going to push some?
Pretty much. I knew about it. I had listened to some, but I was fairly ignorant of the medium and technology and had to learn it really quickly because I was expected to teach it to other people.
So, well, this is interesting because this will be sort of like coming around on the old guitar again when we talk about what happened to you later. But what kind of stuff was in this studio?
It was a Buchla 100 system and two stereo tape recorders. That was pretty much it.
Just two tracks?
A piano, yeah. Two tracks, yeah. And a piano. And a microphone so you could ring modulate something with a piano.
Yeah.
And a desk and a telephone. That was pretty much about it.
And so did you spend a lot of time learning this Buchla synthesizer?
Yes.
Yes, you did.
Yes. I had Hubert Howe's book that came out with the 100. Or did that come out later when CBS took over? You know, I don't honestly remember. I'm not sure. I don't think in 69... that had been printed yet, because CBS, I think, bought it out the next year. But I learned what I could. Mort Subotnick was there about 3 days every 2 weeks. And he would show me how to do something, and then I would, the rest of the time, I was on my own. So that's how that worked.
Did you start composing before then and then switch over to electronics, or did you...
I started composing on the piano, and I was the accompanist for various choral groups, so I had done some choral pieces, and but then I just switched over, and ever since then I've been doing primarily electroacoustic music.
We're always keen to hear people's early music, so if you have some of those piano etudes, we'd love to play them.
No, those have been removed from my performance catalog.
We're happy to embarrass ourselves, and so we like to embarrass everyone else.
The earliest pieces, I will admit to at this point, are from about 72.
Uh-huh. So you accompanied stuff like Frostiana, or what is it you accompanied when you were playing?
Well, actually, a lot of stuff. I was accompanist for the Glee Club, which did a lot of touring, and then I also was the organist at Heinz Chapel. I played not the official organist, but the organist for High Mass every Sunday.
Did that mean you only played the keyboards and not the pedals? Is that what?
No, I played it. I played all.
Oh, you did?
Yes.
Oh,
all four keyboards and the pedals.
You know, I didn't know CalArts had a Glee Club, but I can see that.
No, that was the University of Pittsburgh Glee Club.
All right. Yes, he's still there. Yeah.
Okay.
Still there. They have the big Bessemer converters in the background along with the electronics. Okay. All right. Enough of this funny stuff. Do we have anything early of yours at all we can play from your early electronic music?
No.
We can hear? No, we don't. All right. Well, then.
Well, the earliest you have is the analog music on the Lost Atlantis CD, and the earliest piece there is Trinity, which is from 1976.
Oh, we'll do 76. That works.
Yeah, that's a good start. It's about 15 minutes worth, and which means we'll have a chance to come back and give you our official station ID after we hear that. Our guest is Barry Schrader, and he's going to entertain us the whole time because mm-hmm. this only gets better. Where do you hear some of the things he has to say and who he disses on our program today?
Oh, good.
Yeah, sorry. Here it is, Trinity by Barry Schrader.
The Calvo Sandemian Show.
Bonjour, je m'appelle Pamela Zed.
Konnichiwa.
Bonjour. And you're listening to Calvo Sandemian's New Music Bazaar. Your red alert. Red alert. Your red alert. Your red alert. Alert for new music.
Here on WGDR 91.1 FM, Goddard College, Plainfield, Vermont.
Flagship Island.
The Non-Pop International Network. Ah, that was nice to hear again. Yes, I like that. Calvo Sandemian Show. We need to do more of that. Cheer people up.
We need techno. We need Calvo techno.
Yeah. Hey, that was before we, that rude, humorous interruption, we were listening to a real period piece there, music by Barry Schrader, our guest today. That's Trinity from 1976, you said?
That's right.
Wow. It's coming back.
What, the analog?
Analog, yes.
It's been back.
Well, let's hear about this story. You made a transition for a while after you were working with the analog material to some other stuff, and then you made your way back. Tell a little bit about...
Didn't make my way back to analog, but a lot of other people have. This was done on a Buchla 200 system. It was originally a quadraphonic piece, and this has been mixed down into stereo by Gary Chang. He's done an incredible job, I think, going from the old masters. And I stuck with analog up till about 1984, and then in 85 I transitioned to computers because I figured that the analog situation had sort of had it. Nobody else seemed to be hanging around. But now, in the last several years, analog has come roaring back. There are a lot of people who are collecting, rebuilding old equipment, and a lot of people are building new equipment. And many, many people are composing now with analog. And I hear a lot of it in the commercial world, film and pop music. So it's...
Well, tell someone about your composing and how you work, particularly about sort of the, I don't know what the right word is, the organic way in which you work.
Oh, with analog... I think one of the beautiful things about analog, especially if you had a large system such as the Buchla 200s that we had at CalArts, they were really huge. And in addition, I had special modules built for me by an engineer from Yamaha that I used in these pieces. He was in residence at CalArts in the early 70s. And we called him Fortune. He eventually became one of Yamaha's head acoustic engineers. But he built several modules, which are referred to as the Fortune modules, which I no longer own. CalArts sold them out from under me, unfortunately.
Unfortunately not. No pun there.
But the thing about working with these large analog systems was you could compose... from my point of view, in what I call a kind of gestalt method, so that you could think of all of the musical gestures that you wanted to create at once and just sort of create it wholesale. Whereas if you're writing for instruments or if you're writing for computers, pretty much even if you're thinking on the gestalt level, you have to analyze down until you get to the specific details on the dimensional level and then figure out how to build that back up to what it is.
And why does the analog system allow you to work that way? I mean, you just sort of like turn a knob and say, oh, yeah, that's what I wanted? I mean,
in doing a patch, as you well know, I mean, you could connect all of these modules together. I mean, if you had a little VCS3 or something, you couldn't do this kind of thing. But the Buchla 200 systems, we had, I don't remember how many modules was in the system, but there were at least 50, and we could bring in extras and plug them in on the side. So I was never at a loss for equipment in the studios at CalArts in those days. And you could deal with things like the nature of the pitch, the nature of the rhythm, the nature of the timbre, the nature of the dynamics. If you wanted to have multiple envelopes doing X, Y, or Z or whatever, so you could set all of this up. And unlike in the classical studio, you know, when you're cutting and splicing, you got instant feedback from what you're doing, so you knew, yeah, this is what it is that I want. And you, the problem then was recording it, getting a good recording of it. Hopefully before the next person was coming into the studio, because if you had to tear the patch out, it was a problem. You know, could you get that patch back? But I eventually developed a system using a volt ohm meter where I would take voltages down to two decimal places. So I was able to get stuff back absolutely precisely for my next session. So that's what I meant by being able to get everything at once, all the gestalt, all the gestures that you would want in a particular musical gestalt, and then experiment with how you could change that, because like in this piece, one of the things that I do, which is part, I think, of almost all of my composition, is deal with timbral transformations and creating, timbres which are changing through time. They're not steady state or stagnant, and you could hear that happening in real time. In fact, in this piece, or even in almost all my analog stuff, I never did any cutting and splicing. I was lousy at that. I really couldn't make a clean splice. So what I learned to do was program the analog equipment so that I would be able to get for a specific section everything that I wanted. And then I just did the kind of A-B technique that I was used to from doing some early film scoring, where on a flatbed you would have, you know, the two or three soundtracks, and you would simply be able to fade things in and out, multiple. So I had to have multiple tape recorders to be able to mix down. And most of the, when you get down like to the master of the piece, it's usually third, fourth, sometimes even fifth generation, because I've mixed so many different tracks down. So it wasn't unusual for me to have somewhere between 20 and 40 tracks in the final version of a mixed down piece. So, but I didn't have to do any cutting or splicing.
So you're essentially playing each one live as you went ahead.
Each track
live.
Right. And I would make up timing charts so that I would know when to press what button when and turn this pot, whatever. And I would rehearse it just like you would rehearse performing a piece. And then I would record them track by track by track. It's a very laborious process. And what you're always sweating is, you know, is this recording going to be okay? You have to listen to each one after you make it. Were there any pops or clicks that got in there, you know, from the water fountain that went on outside or something? And but that's how I proceeded. But I think there was a kind of a power in being able to create directly from what you could think in terms of the patch. Whereas working with the computer, you have to start at the lowest level creating the information that you're going to build up. And I think it's only fairly recently that I've been able to get back to something that sort of parallels that kind of gestalt thinking by using the computer.
What has made that possible? Just the technology has gotten more powerful.
I think
plugins or something, or how?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I also think it's just having done it for so long that my facility is better. I think that if you listen to my earlier computer stuff, it's more what I call event-based than gestalt-based.
Okay.
And whereas I think a lot of the more recent computer stuff is more gestalt-based.
Sounds like he's ready for some piano music.
Yes, event-based.
Yeah, I think event-based piano music. Yeah, I think that's coming.
We have something from that middle period we can hear. Give our audience an example of what you mean by that.
Well, the earliest finished piece I did with the computer was Bacahama from 1976. It's on the EAM album. And unfortunately, this has been compared, well, unfortunately, from my point of view, to Wendy Carlos's work, which is absolutely not the idea at all. But I took...
So what? Tell us quickly what the idea is so that the people can sort of peel the onion skin off here of Wendy
Okay,
Carlos.
Well, this is in three short sections, Fugue 0.1, Air, and Fugue 0.2. And it's the fugues are based on the C minor, a fugue from the Well-Tempered Clavier, and the air is based on the air from the G string. But what happens is that the fugues start out sort of similar, I mean, playing the music straight except in multiple voices and extremely fast. But then I dissect all of the pitch information, and it radically changes. And also there are, you know, different kinds of delays and electronic treatments of it. And the air also is taking it's playing with the idea of what you know, what you expect, but changing around. So the pitch material comes back in a very different way. And there's a long transformational timbre that's used here, so it keeps layering over itself. So even though you're just hearing one pitch at a time, it layers into these vertical structures that keep constantly changing because each one is fading away at a different rate.
From the EAM CD, this is, by the way, on Innova, as are the other CDs, Lost Atlantis and the upcoming one as well,
right.
Which is
Beyond.
Our guest is Barry Schrader. Here it is, the Bacarama. No,
Bacahama.
Bacahama. Bacarama. Bacarama! It's not Bacharach.
Thank you.
From the CD EAM by Barry Schrader, that's Bacahama. You were saying some things to us while that was playing about how you work and particularly how people get familiar with the equipment they're working with, and if they don't, maybe they don't get to be real sort of masters of that equipment. Maybe you could run through that again, because it's
really
interesting concept.
In the area of electroacoustic music, you've gone through so many changes. I mean, if you go back to 1948, from which point you have a continuous history. Pierre Schaeffer started out working, of course, with turntables and discs, and he was very reticent after having perfected his techniques in the early 50s of moving into tape. It was actually Pierre Henri that forced him into getting tape machines and using those in the studio. So you go through that kind of classical period with the tape manipulation techniques, and then you move into the analog period. And then you move into the computer period, which has several different incarnations, you know, starting at Bell Labs, but in terms of most composers, really beginning with when laptops became affordable in the middle 80s. And all the time you're going through new pieces of equipment or new techniques, new pieces of software, and you're constantly learning and trying to keep up. And I think it becomes problematic because you master one situation, and then before you know it, you have to go into another one. And I've seen several people who have gone through maybe one change or two changes, but just not been able to constantly keep up. Some of the pioneering composers I've known in my life in the field of electroacoustic music, you know, never really made it into, like, the computer situation because they just felt much more at home in what they had learned years before.
And it seems like that's really actually not a problem. From what you've described, particularly kind of an interest in technology, particularly analog technology undergoing a resurgence, sort of suggests that maybe there is enough technology to effectively carry off the kind of composition that one might want to do?
Today, that's absolutely correct,
yeah.
Especially outside of the academic world. But inside the academic world, there are always pressures to do what might be considered de rigueur in a particular situation. Outside of that, I don't think there is that pressure. And I remember writing an article many years ago in the early 80s talking about a time when analog and digital would coexist side by side, and people thought I was nuts. But now that's true today. So you can pick and choose what it is that you like. But there is, in some quarters, there is a kind of technological snobbery. And one of, or more of these people that feel this way may not value a particular piece if it's not done with what they consider to be a relevant piece of software or something like that.
Yeah, we were actually talking about that over lunch today, because I know that I've experienced that myself, because I do a lot of electroacoustic music, and which gets a certain amount of interest in certain quarters, as you would say, until I mention that I make those creations with software that runs under Windows, and then I get folks who begin to diss it because it obviously couldn't be well created if it were done in the realm in which
right. Well, I remember once at a conference years ago, somebody asked me what I did a certain piece with, and I told them, and they said, "Oh yeah, somebody I know used that, and they did everything that you could possibly do with it." And that reminded me way back in 1970, after CBS had bought out the Buchla 100 system. They asked me to do some demos for them, and they sent me to the University of Chicago, which was going to set up an electronic music studio. And the week before, somebody had been there demonstrating a Moog. And that week I was there demonstrating the Buchla 100. And I was very naive. I was, 25 years old. And even though I had been used to the academic world, I was not really prepared for what happened, which was most of the people were there to attack the system I was presenting, and I guess secondarily to attack me, but especially to attack the entire medium. So the first range of attacks was, well, the reason you can do more with this equipment is because you've got more modules than the guy had from Moog. And then after that, which was the much more serious attack, was everything that's been done in electronic music has already been done. That in Stockhausen in Kontakte had created everything that was possible in the realm of electronic music, and it's really a waste of your time and our time to even consider this stuff.
Oh. So, well, it's true. Yeah. Between that and Gazang, I mean, everything has been done. Yeah.
So,
by 1957.
That was my break-in to the realization of this attitude.
Well, how did you respond? I mean, did you respond, or were you just sort of stunned into your demo? And
I was sort of stunned. I mean, I said, respectfully, I disagree. But I was pretty stunned. I don't think I had a very good comeback. Not especially when you had multiple faculty, ready to gang up on you.
Oh, well, who were some of these?
I do not know any of these people. Oh. There was an audience of about 40 or so people for the demo, and I didn't know any of them.
Hmm.
So anyway, I realized from that point on that there were always going to be people that were going to attack perhaps the medium itself or certainly any particular piece based upon the technology that was used to do that piece, for which reason I really don't like discussing the technology. I mean, I will with my students and go into detail on that, but in general, I believe that what's important is the music, mm-hmm. not what made it.
Mm-hmm.
And if a composer is able to achieve their goals and create something that works in their terms with whatever technology they want to use, I think that that's terrific. I think the technology is always secondary to the product. And I think the composer is much more important than the technology. People, that's another thing about the field that's always amusing me. People are always blaming the equipment. Oh, I can't do this because the program won't let me do this. The equipment won't let me do this. And I hear this a lot from students. But
it's a good cop.
Works every time. Yeah.
Can't do that. But the problem is you're always faced with the limitations. So you try to make pluses out of those limitations, and you take that as a given, and then you do as much as you possibly can. It really makes no sense to blame the technology, whatever it is you're working with, for some shortcoming that's really your fault.
Let's hear some more of
product.
Product, yes. Let's hear some product here. Yes, yes, we love product.
Mm-hmm.
Suggest some product for us. Perhaps something from Lost Atlantis.
Okay.
Unless you want something else or something from your new CD.
Product.
Product.
Good heavens. I wasn't prepared. How about going back to analog then, Lost Atlantis? Well, my favorite, but you already played that.
What's
one,
that?
Is the destruction of Atlantis. But I think you already played that.
Well, we did, but now this puts us in context.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. The reason I like that, this is in two parts, the destruction of Atlantis and then the epilogue, which is "An Atlantis Shall Rise." And especially in the epilogue, the second part of this, is a really extreme example of what I call linear timbral transformation that was done with analog equipment, where the timbre is just constantly evolving from a very simple, almost sinusoidal sound into eventually these huge waves of noise, and then back again at the end.
Crank this one up, folks, because this will give your system a test. We love this part. Here is from Lost Atlantis. This is the destruction of Atlantis and the epilogue, and Atlantis Shall Rise. This is from the CD Lost Atlantis on Innova. Our guest is Barry Schrader. Music by Barry Schrader. That's from Lost Atlantis CD on Innova, The Destruction of Atlantis, and the epilogue, And Atlantis Shall Rise.
You know, I heard water, even though there was no, there didn't seem to be a water sample or anything, but it just, it felt
Use the
fluid.
Q-tips. It'll get much better.
Oh, okay. I can clean it out and then just soak it out.
So, where are you going with this now? I mean, this piece dates from when?
This is 1977.
Right. So I stuck with
analog up through the last big piece I did. It's called Moon Whales and Other Moon Songs, which very well may be lost because the masters, that was from 82, 83, maybe into 84, and I was using Ampex 456, which and when I took those masters out to try to transfer them,
they jammed the tape recorder.
They're all
stuck.
Warped, and yep. it sounds so. I have mediocre transfers, but I wasn't able to get transfers from the master, so that may be lost. I don't know.
Well, we'll talk to you a little while
there's a service that's available through this website.
Yes, we'll tell you when we're listening
even
to something
warp
else.
Tape.
Especially.
Yeah. Wow.
So, all right. What did you run into as your sort of biggest problem psychologically when you started using computer digital technology?
The fact that I couldn't couldn't do gestalt composition.
But you're doing that now, so how did you overcome it? Did you change or did it change?
Okay, let me tell you what I used to do.
All right.
Like when I was doing Atlantis. I'm a night person, basically. I mean, right now this is sort of morning for me in my normal life. And so I would work all night, and I would start off going maybe to a coffee shop with a lot of pieces of paper and pencil, and I would make these sketches that would be the basis for these pieces, these analog pieces. And I still have some of them. I thought I threw them all away, but a few years ago I found some. And they were meaningless, of course, except to me. But I was able, you know, to deal with the whole schmear, the whole concept all at once. Then when I got into computer stuff, I realized I couldn't do that. I had to say, I want this frequency for this duration at this amplitude, and the timbre has to be constructed, and so forth. And so what's happened to me over the years is that I've just gotten more and more used to working with the computer, and it's become more and more second nature. I work mostly in event lists, and then I use also editing software for constructing the timbres using additive synthesis, frequency modulation, amplitude modulation, transfers. I mean, all the usual culprits. Okay.
Now,
what I will do is I start out now. Again, I have a notion of what the thing is going to be, and the first thing I will do is design the timbres for the piece, because I want the timbres to do certain kinds of things, and so they have to be specially designed to do that. And then after I've designed the timbres, which I usually make families of these different timbres, I'll start composing the piece in the event lists, but I've had to analyze down from the overall idea, the gestalt, the gesture, whatever you want to call it, so that I know that putting all of this dimensional information together will give me what I want. And I've already designed the timbres so that they're always time-variant structures, because I think one of the killers with computer music is, for lack of a better term, steady state kinds of timbres. So
the correct term is boring.
So they have to be time variant so that they seem to be, you know, natural in some way, even though they're not to the ear. And after years of doing this now, we're talking about 20 years,
yep.
I've just hopefully have gotten better.
You say you work in event list, though. Are the graphical interfaces not satisfactory to what you do?
Well, I work in event lists within inside programs that specify, the pitch, the duration, stuff like that. But I also now more and more, going back to the Gestalt ideas,
yeah.
I will generate electronic material because everything we've heard is electronically generated.
That's another question
done one totally complete computer concrete piece.
Okay.
I'll record the electronic material and then I'll take it into a program that will allow me to manipulate it in a lot of different ways. And at that point, I'm not working in event lists. At that point, I'm really working closer to maybe what I had been doing in the past with analog equipment because I'm dealing with different ways of processing that, in a sense, I guess, in real time because I'm hearing it instantly, you know, to make sure that I'm getting what it is that I want. So I don't work entirely in event lists anymore because very often I'm working with, especially in death in certain sections, with sound masses, similar to the piece of the section of Atlantis we just heard where, you know, there were a lot of mass structures in there.
And that gets to that question of the generation of the material. You work with the generation being electronic,
right,
rather than snatching segments of acoustic sound from other things like instruments or voices or concrete sounds or garbage can lid samples.
Right. Well, it's interesting, of course, when you go back again to the beginning of the continuous history, 48. Most of what Schaefer was doing and his cohorts in Paris then was concrete, using acoustic generated material. And then you had the other camp with Eimert and eventually Stockhausen over in Cologne using only electronically generated material. And there was a kind of a little war going on throughout maybe the first half of the 50s. You know, either it was concrete or it was electronic. And then people started mixing them together. And in the analog days, of course, everything that people were doing with analog was electronic. But in Europe, concrete stayed very popular because they weren't using so much analog. They were staying mainly with the classical studio techniques. When the computer came in and MIDI equipment, at first I think people started experimenting with electronics, but eventually in the United States, what has become primary for computer-based, non-analog equipment, because a lot of analog equipment is controlled by computer now. But anyway, in computer-based works is computer concrete. And the philosophy there is, well, if you take a sound that was acoustically generated, it's already going to be complex. It's going to have a complex timbre structure. It's going to have a time-variant timbre structure. And there's a lot of ways that you can manipulate that, and that, therefore, is going to make an interesting composition. And I would say that the overwhelming majority, from what I hear, way over 90% of what's coming out, especially of music done by academic composers, is computer concrete. But that doesn't, for some reason, I have remained interested in electronically generated material. And I think part of it is because I want to be able to design my timbres from the ground up. I want to be able to control them, as I said before, maybe design a specific timbre for a specific piece because of something I want it to do. And it's part of the, if I can use the word fun, but it's certainly adventure in terms
you're,
of...
You're not in academia right now, so you can say
okay.
Fun.
It's part of the thing that interests me in the whole process. And I know that I'm not entirely alone, but I'm close to being alone in terms of of working that way at this point in time.
You mean your students don't follow this line of thought?
No. I do have, in one class, I do have them create an all electronically generated piece, and it's probably the least favorite of the assignments that they have to do. They definitely like the concrete pieces better. And sometimes, I'm not trying to denigrate, you know, working with concrete stuff, but it can be maybe easier if you start out with something that's already interesting and complex. If you start with electronic generation of material, and I think this is why the students don't like it, you've got to know some theory. And it's never too popular when I start putting some formulas and so forth up on the blackboard.
Oh, yeah.
But you do have to know some theory in order to understand what it is you're doing. So whereas with concrete stuff, you can, I think, be more intuitive. It's pretty hard to be intuitive if you've got a bunch of sine waves coming off the computer and, you know, you're wondering what to do, you know, with them. So, but for me, it's fascinating, and I'm always seeing how far I can keep, you know, pushing the envelope, to use a cliche, in terms of creating sounds. And a lot of people are surprised when they find out that my music is done with all digital, electronically generated material, as opposed to some concrete or even analog. Some people have thought some of the electronic stuff I've done is analog when it's actually digital.
Let's hear something more recent.
Okay.
Something short to start with, and then we'll listen to something a little bit longer later.
Okay. Well, do you want to listen to the one and only totally concrete piece at this point?
Why not?
Yeah. Okay. This is called Beyond, and it is from 1992, and it was composed, I will get a little technical with this one. This was composed at the University of California at Santa Barbara, and it uses two sound sources, water phones and harpsichord sounds.
Okay.
And it was done on a workstation that they had there that was primary. It was called a wave frame. I don't think you need all the fingers on both hands to count up the number of academic pieces that were done with this system because the University of California, Santa Barbara is the only place that has one. They were primarily designed for work in Hollywood, and Warner Brothers used them for many years in the late 80s through the mid-90s before the software that exists today became common to mix down especially dialogue and stuff. And the reason that UCSB got one for free was that they have an extensive ethnomusicology collection of instruments, non-Western instruments, and they allowed the company to sample all of their instruments in exchange for getting one of these. Yeah. One of these, they started at about $100,000 in the
time.
Yeah, at the time.
And now I can probably do it on my desktop, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
It used a huge computer, which had to be a proprietary computer, which had to be in a different room because it was so noisy. And then on top of that computer was I think it was a 286 at the time. And then on top of that was a Macintosh. So you were dealing with three computers at once to use this, and it was constantly crashing. and the software is divided up so that different programs would deal with different aspects of what you were doing. It was one program for mixing, one program for dealing like with wave formatting. I mean, it was a little complicated. So I did this piece on that system, which had, for the time, absolutely incredible control and incredible facility. But you're right, today you could do it in your living room.
Before we get to hear this piece, we're going to have a little business to take care of. So we're putting a piece of paper in front of you, and we will give you an 8-second warning. And
just think of it as just in terms of your addressing your class.
Yeah, here's your 8-second warning coming right now. The wrong one, and now we'll have the 8-second warning.
Calvos and Damian's New Music Bazaar.
Hello, bonjour. My name is Barry Schrader, and you're listening to Calvos and Damian's New Music Bazaar, your one stop for non-pop.
Here on WGDR 91.1 FM, Goddard College, Plainfield, Vermont. Community radio, they call us. Are we still community radio?
We're communicative. We have communicative problems.
But if nothing else, we are...
Non-pop?
The flagship of...
We are?
The Non-Pop International Network. We didn't hear that yet.
Oh, right. I remember that.
Yes. All right, now let's hear that tune by Barry Schrader. This is... What's the title of it again?
Beyond.
From 1992, you say?
That's correct.
Music by Barry Schrader. That's from an upcoming CD. What will be the CD we call it that one's? That's
Beyond. It's named after that piece.
And it's named after that piece. Okay. And your point with this one was?
Well, that's my only completely concrete piece of music, computer concrete.
And the source material was what?
Harpsichords and
water phones. Yeah.
Different kinds of water phones.
Yeah. Now, in terms of the results, now this is interesting because we were talking about earlier about how you don't talk about the equipment you used, but you don't talk about the source material necessarily, or even if you talk about the source material, if the results are similar or just as gratifying, whatever way you want to talk about it, why do you work with largely electronic generation and avoid the computer concrete?
Well, the reason that this is computer concrete is because in order to use the waveframe, you had to have pre-existing sound sources.
Okay.
So,
but you could have made those electronic and used those as your
original
sound source.
Not in that room.
Oh, not in
that
room.
The studio that the waveframe was housed in. I would have had to have gone to a different studio and dragged some files in. And so I didn't want to do that. And also I hadn't done a purely concrete piece. And so I thought it would be interesting to try it once.
Yeah. But to the question itself, though, I mean, if you can do it with that, and if the results give that sort of that feel of the Barry Schrader feel, is it familiarity that keeps you working the other way, or is it because you like that control at the very outset?
Well, both. Actually, the way I use the concrete material is very similar to the way I would use electronic material. I mean, I took the samples and broke them up and piled them up into timbral structures, and so it doesn't. Many people have said this sounds more analog than concrete, which is sort of strange. But and I think it's because of the way that I used it. So I had the same attitude as I would in terms of using creating something electronically. And I think you put your finger on it. It's because of the control and because it's the way I'm used to working and the way I'm used to thinking. I'm not saying anything against.
I was just curious as to if as I say, it's sort of that distinctive sound. You can produce it either way. Why was that your preference? I think you answered that.
Right, and as we were talking before about the idea of what one is trying to accomplish in music, at going back to lunch, which our listeners were not privy to, but when I talked about trying to regain that sense of magic, that sense of creating an individual universe that I felt in terms of listening to music as a child, I think that being able to create your own timbres from the ground up goes, for me, somewhat more to the heart of that. It's a very personal thing. Maybe I can't really give a satisfactory answer. And I can't honestly say that for the rest of my life I would never veer off into working again with concrete. But right now, and for most of my career, it's been electronically generated material that has really fascinated me.
Have you heard anything that you might think, oh, I want to try to do that, but you have such a singular repertoire? I mean, it is so Barry Schrader, as Calvo said. Do you ever think of maybe just going out and doing something techno?
No.
Oh, okay. Well,
be quite honest, no. I think the closest I got to doing something that maybe wasn't so much me was a commercial horror sci-fi film.
Ooh.
That I did.
Oh, we love these.
It was a 1982, I think. It was a Roger Corman movie.
Our favorite man.
Called Galaxy of Terror, a film which I believe is fortunately unavailable.
Oh, no.
At least in the United States. And
That was an interesting experience.
I think we're doing a Galaxy of Terror search.
We're doing a search right now. We're going to see if it's available.
I think it's available in Europe, but not the United States on a DVD. It was not exactly one of the great classics of cinema, but and that was done with a Buchla system.
Ah, there it is, Galaxy of Terror, available in the U.S. still on VHS.
Oh, right. Okay.
And available in the UK on DVD as well as on VHS. So,
what are the credits?
Full cast and crew. Well, we'll just check that out right now. And it says down here, original music by Barry Schrader.
All right,
there it is. And it does not apparently, from the user comments, get really high. it's not highly regarded.
Edward Albert?
Yeah.
All right.
Yes, as is the case with a slew of Roger Corman-produced films, this flick underwent several title changes, da da da, and it goes on from there.
It's not exactly 2001.
Biosensors.
Speaking of 2001, we haven't heard anything from the new millennium of yours.
Oh, well, we have several things here. Actually, from the last few years. Let's see. Well, here's something that I just finished, but you know what? Well, do you want to be adventuresome?
And use
the CD that's never been played?
I think so. This Virgin CD, we love those.
Hopefully it won't skip.
That could be part of the process, part of the product.
That's true. If you're a fan of John Cage, that's certainly true. But let's listen to First Spring, which is very recent, from 2004. And there's a long story behind this, so I'm sure you want me to tell it. I had been commissioned to do a piece for violin in electronics by violinist at CalArts, Mark Menzies. And he's a really terrific violinist. I didn't know what to do. I didn't have an idea. I was cleaning up around my house one winter day, and even though I live in California, I live up in the high desert, and it gets cold in the winter up there. It can even go down almost to zero at night sometimes. And I found outside of the clothes dryer vent where the lint comes out, that a sparrow the night before had made a little nest out of the lint and died there. And I was very touched by that, in, you know, this bird seeking some comfort in the last moments of its life. And I started to think of what might have been going through the bird's mind as it died, what it might have remembered. And it was out of that this violin piece came, which is called Fallen Sparrow. And the first large section of the piece is called First Spring, because I imagine that it was probably very impressed with its first spring when all of the various forms of life were new to it. And while I was doing the electronics for the piece, I really began to fall in love with them. And I decided to make a solo studio piece out of it, just a solo electronic version, different from the accompaniment that would go along for the violin piece. And that's what this is, First Spring.
Thank you.
First Spring by Barry Schrader. That's coming up on a CD.
Beyond. It will be released on Anova at the end of September.
Of 2005.
And maybe available a little earlier. People should check my website. And if they want, sign up for my newsletter.
Ooh, newsletter.
Immediately when it comes out.
BarrySchrader.com, by the way.
Right.
And you can find it. He's got good pictures.
Free lint with each recording.
Free lint. Yes, free lint. We love the free lint. Got to have the free lint. We're going to hear Duke's tune in just a second. I want to mention that upcoming on Calvis and Damien. Next week, David Kidwell, composer and conductor from Southern Vermont, will be here. And we'll hear some of his orchestral music. He'll tell us about what he does. And we'll, because he's a fellow local, we'll get to abuse him more than our regular guests.
Ask him why he didn't show up at the festival last week.
Yes, exactly. July 23rd, Judith Shayton will be here. She's coming up from the Mid-South, assuming she survives the hurricanes.
Hmm.
She'll be here. And then the 30th of July, Gene Pritzker and Charles Coleman will be coming up from Manhattan, and they're going to, I don't know what they're going to do, but the two of them are pretty funny individually, so who knows what will happen.
A little microphone abuse.
It could be. And then August 6th, we have the group Bird Brain, which includes Yvette Perez and Peter Zummel and others. And they'll be here in Studio Z and giving us some lots of fun to deal with. So that's coming up, and David Kidwell will be next week. Today, right here with us is Barry Schrader, and we're going to wrap up with Duke's tune. Tell us a little bit about us. But before that, what are you doing next? What's coming up? What's for you?
I'm working on two pieces right now. Monkey, which is a huge multi-movement piece, the first movement of which is going to be premiered in Beijing in October. It's based on the Chinese classic, The Journey to the West, and the central character of which is Monkey. And I'm also working on a collaborative piece with jazz trumpeter Wadada Leo Smith, which will be premiered in November on his concert at Red Cat at Disney Hall in L.A. So that's what I'm currently working on. But I'll tell you about Duke's tune. We're just going to be able to hear a little of the beginning of it. And this is also coming out on the Beyond CD in September.
Right.
We are into Potbelly Pigs. We sponsor a shelter for Potbelly Pigs in Solvang, California, run by Susan Parkinson.
And lint?
No, we're not a fan of lint.
Oh, okay.
But the shelter's called Little Orphan Hammies.
Oh, ow.
And,
ow, you may leave now.
One of the pigs there, his name is Duke, and he plays several instruments, one of which is the xylophone. And Susan videotaped him playing the xylophone. And I took the tune that he played on his xylophone and transcribed it, and that's the basis for this piece. So the tune goes through, I don't know how many, dozens and dozens of transformations. What you hear at the very, very beginning of the piece is the original tune, and then it's all over the place.
So are we.
Yes, Barry Schrader, thanks so much for joining us on Cowboys and Damien.
production of Multimedia.